Good morning, everybody. It's good to be here. I've met some of you at various times over the past few weeks when we've been doing impromptu press statements. But this is the first official one that I've done, and I'm suggesting that we do this regularly. And if a situation or an event permits, we would put on a special one in addition to that. As Daniel said, it's a great pleasure to have Radio Moriah tuned in on this live. I mean, I think that's excellent, and the fact that we have so much coverage with Radio Moriah across the country is a real asset for people to be able to hear this as well. I'll just make a couple of brief points, and then I'm happy to take questions from people here. First of all, I mean, I've been here just a little over a month now. It's been as you can imagine, a time when I've been trying to get an understanding of what is happening in the country. I've been meeting many people within the government, some within the opposition, and most importantly, travelling around the country. So I've been to Rumbek, visited Wau, Benchu, Malakal. Today, straight after this conference, I'll be going down to Yambio, and I am intending to travel at least one day, probably 2 days every week, for the simple reason that while here in Juba there's 500,000 people, there's 11 million people out there in the rest of the country, and I want to be able to have a good look and see the situation and the context, both the political, humanitarian and the economic context in which people are living. So being able to get around and talk to people, just ordinary South Sudanese citizens, wherever I meet them, has been a priority for me, and I will continue to do that during course of being the SRSG here. And that has been, I have to say, just a comment on that, it's been a really interesting time for me to be able to understand what's going on, both in terms of understanding the very complicated and often very different contexts in every place that I have been. Rumbek, the tensions in Rumbek are very different from the tensions that I saw in Malakal, for example, because of the politics, the ethnic makeup, etc. So it's important that we understand the context. But also from the point of view of understanding what the UN is doing out in the field, and a lot of what we're doing is unreported. Some of the civil affairs work that, for example, that we're doing, bringing groups together, people together, working alongside the governors to be able to encourage dialogue and reconciliation, for example, is one thing that is very rarely reported and yet is very important to the work that the UN is doing. So, as I say, I will continue to do that. Just a couple of mentions, I think, of the big news of this week, and that is yesterday, as you all know, the President gave his address to the Parliament. I was there and present, and just a couple of comments on that. First of all, I thought that his remarks about the national dialogue, basically expanding on what he had mentioned already in December, were welcome. The fact that this is going to be something that will be led by the South Sudanese, we anticipate and expected that, which is good. And secondly, that, and I think for the United Nations, it's our issue is we have had a considerable amount of experience with national dialogues across the world. We've had a couple of experts in here over the past week or so on how to, you know, in terms of running national dialogues, what we've learned from other places, and we are ready to provide that support to the government as they progress forward. I think the most important thing for us is to make sure that any national dialogue is inclusive. That means that we are looking at the widest range of actors coming into that. If we are going to be genuine about seeking peace and ultimately there's some reconciliation involved in that, then we have to spread the dialogue wide. But I certainly welcome the President's attention to the national dialogue and the way that he laid it out. Also in his speech he mentioned the issue of access. This is something that the international community, certainly the United Nations and many humanitarian organisations have struggled with, gaining access. There's obviously logistical problems in the state of roads, but more importantly it's being able to get through checkpoints and get permissions to be able to travel from one place to another. And the fact that he made a mention of this in his speech, and that he would ensure that we were able to get to particular areas was very welcome as well, and we'll certainly follow up on that as well. So I thought the speech certainly touched on a number of issues which were of interest to us, and we'll continue that on, and it's good to get that sort of interest at the highest level within the country. The other thing that I just wanted to touch on was the report of the FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN, that came out on Monday, and this was about the famine situation in parts of Unity State and the food deficits in other parts of the country as well. I had visited Unity State and some of those areas around Leah just 2 weeks ago, so I can confirm that the situation there is indeed serious in terms of food shortages. And I guess the two or three issues that I just want to point out is, first of all, there is nothing about these food shortages which is about a drought or climatic problems. It is all about man-made problems, which is conflict, which has displaced people. It has meant that people are not able to partake in their ordinary livelihoods. They've been displaced, and as a result of that, find themselves short of coping mechanisms and have to rely on outside food aid. This is not a situation that we would like to see. We want to see people on their own, in their own homes, on their land, and being able to cope for themselves. Secondly, the issue is obviously of trying to address some of those shortfalls, and that's what the United Nations will try and do with obviously the support of donors. There's going to be a need to be a very big donor mobilisation in terms of being able to attract money to fund the shortfalls. And we're looking at a $1.6 billion humanitarian appeal this year. It's an enormous amount of money. Particularly tragic, as I say, because most of the problems are brought about because there isn't peace in the country and people are leaving and fleeing their homes. So obviously a ceasefire and getting back onto the track of the peace process is we believe, is a priority, not just for the future of the country, but obviously for the people who are suffering most, which are, as always, women and children in many of these places which can't be accessed. So let me leave it there, and I'm happy to take further questions. I just want to touch on those three points. Obviously, my introductory remarks about being here for 1 month, the national dialogue, and the results of the FAO food survey that came out recently.
Thank you very much. I'm Cole Dennis, working with Reuters News Agency. Given the recent higher-level resignation by the military officers in charge of the SPLA court, what does the UN think about whether soldiers are accountable for abuses? And is UNMISS following up on the case of Kubi gang rape case, for example? Thank you.
Just in terms of the resignations of staff, I don't have a comment on that. That's something that it's really about the government to address, rather than who is in the government and who's not in the government. I mean, they've stated their reasons for leaving, and I have no ability to verify one way or the other about that. When it comes to trying and holding soldiers to account for possible atrocities that they have committed, yes, absolutely. We believe that is the position of the government, that these soldiers should be held to account, that they should be put in front of a proper tribunal or a court, and their case be heard. I was pleased to see that there was a change in direction in terms of ensuring that people are given a trial before any punishment might be meted out. When the UN does not sanction executions, but we definitely believe that any sort of climate of impunity only encourages more atrocities to take place. So it's important that the government stamps down firmly on any abuses that might occur in the course of operations, and make sure that goes before a proper judicial process.
My name is Luak Nelson. I report for Radio Maria. Recently, we've had a situation in Washalok. I just read a release yesterday by citizens that they were denied access into the area. Now, I'm wondering, what does the mission know about the situation in Washalok?
Yes, I was in Malakal last week. We had discussions with the SPLA, with the governor there, and we have wanted to get into Walshuluk for the last few days. So far, we have been denied access by the SPLA. The reason we want to get access into the area is simply because we want to see the plight of the civilians and what needs are there so that we can mobilise potential humanitarian assistance to assist those people. We are continuing to try to get into Walshuluk and also to Kadok, further north along the Nile River, where we understand many people have fled to. But at the moment, we lack the ability to understand exactly what the situation for people is, and that's our sole concern, which is about making sure that we are able to address, we think, about 20,000 people which have fled Walshuluk and are likely to be heading north on the west bank of the Nile, and what their situation might be.
This is Hebo Morgan from Al Jazeera. So the UN has been calling for a return to the peace process since July, maybe even before that. And all we've seen since then is more people fleeing, more fighting, lack of access to humanitarian actors. And now we've got the declaration of famine. Isn't it time you tried something else besides calling the government to return to the peace process?
Well, I think the peace process has been set down. It's well established. There has been significant discussions by regional partners, which at the end of the day are the parents of the peace process in terms of IGAD and JMEC that are here on the ground. They have the particular role of monitoring and ensuring that the various phases of the peace process are undertaken. And there has been I was in Addis about 3 weeks ago, where there was certainly an agreement amongst the IGAD countries and the AU about providing a greater degree of focus from President Konare and from President Mahai here and on the ground to move things forward. But ultimately, when it comes to peace, that peace is in the hands of the government and the opposition groups here in the country. I mean, it has to be on the basis of a negotiated settlement. And so having those players involved is a positive thing, but ultimately it lies in the hands of those people who are fighting. That's where peace ultimately rests with.
I'm Yuna Kwadatim. I work for the DPA News Agency. You mentioned that the famine which was declared 2 days ago is a man-made. Can you elaborate more on that? Second, what will be the intervention or the role played by UN or UNMISS, seeing there is food deficit in the country?
In contrast to other parts of the region and the East Africa region, where, for example, in Ethiopia they're suffering from drought, and that has been the reason for their shortfall. Here in South Sudan, with the exception of the area around Kapaweta and the very extreme sort of southeast, there hasn't been any climatic issues around a food deficit. What instead is happening, and particularly with the fighting in the Equatorias, which has traditionally been, as you know, the food basket of South Sudan, we've had many hundreds of thousands of people fleeing that area, which means that they are not producing food, which means that there's a just in that area, there's a 100,000 metric ton deficit in food as a result of production that will not go ahead because people are simply not there. So they are fleeing because of conflict, they're fleeing because they fear for their lives, and as a result of that, we have a food deficit. On top of that, the conflict has exacerbated the economic situation. So the inflation rate has meant that people's ability to buy food with South Sudanese pounds has been eroded, and that has also created major problems, and particularly for people up in the Western Barra Ghazal and up that area, which has relied on trade and food being able to get up there. We're seeing livestock prices falling and cereal prices rising. And that's creating problems for families in those areas as well. So that's what I mean by man-made situation. In terms of intervention, we will have to, obviously the World Food Programme, who leads this operation and has been doing so very successfully and very professionally over the last few years, will continue its plan for the distribution of food. And where there is food, obviously what we would like to do is to be able to move food by road, because we can move most by road or in some cases by barge. We are having problems with access. With the rainy season coming, the roads from, for example, Juba to Wau and through to Benchu and around that arc around the western part of the country will become more difficult with rains. But we're also seeing a multiplying of the number of small checkpoints which are along that road as well. And there are now several dozen checkpoints which stop our vehicles and for various reasons. And that's why I was pleased that the President mentioned in his speech that they would facilitate access, because that message has to go right down to not just from the generals, but right down to the unlisted people on checkpoints. They will roll out a very large program, and where we can't reach areas by road or by barge, then we will have to consider airdrops, but they are hugely expensive and don't deliver the amount of food that is needed in those particular areas, particularly in Unity State, which is the most severe. I have to say, the world hasn't declared famine for 5 years in any area of the world. This is the first time it's happened in the last in 5 years. It's sad that it has to happen in South Sudan, but we'll certainly do our best to reach those people, those citizens of South Sudan who are not getting enough food.
Now, Majoka, I work for This Day newspaper. In your own opinion, as you have seen the political situation, the senior members of the government are resigning from the government. And there are also some analysts from across the country and outside the country are criticizing the national dialogue that is not going to be inclusive, since there are other people that are fighting the government. In your own opinion, how is it going to be inclusive in terms of peace building?
I think that's a very important question. We've said from the very beginning, when the national dialogue was first announced, the UN would support an inclusive national dialogue, so it has to be inclusive. But the second point is, we haven't seen the details of the national dialogue yet, only the sort of the broad kind of layout of how it might go ahead. So we're waiting to see how those details might emerge. But I think the third thing is that, as you say, it has to be inclusive, and therefore we will offer the support that we can provide to make sure that that happens. And we have been involved in national dialogues in Yemen, Tunisia, Mali, just to name a few, where the UN has supported national efforts on the ground to bring the various parties together. And we have offered that support, and we will provide that support so that it does meet what we would like to consider the conditions to making sure that this national dialogue is in fact inclusive.
Yes, thank you. My name is Wake from the VOA. I would just like to ask you a question on the peace agreement implementation. You did say the peace agreement is a well-established deal. You already 1 month here so far in South Sudan since you were posted. Are you convinced on the full implementation of the peace deal as per the status so far right now? The second or last question is on the issue of the access. How serious is the issue of accessibility?
Just on your first point, I mean, I think I touched on that before, which is to say that there is a peace agreement that is well established. I think that after the fighting of last year, that has the process has definitely not taken place or not progressed in the way that we would want it to. That's obvious. What we are hoping with the engagement of the international community and particularly the regional community, that we might be able to get it back onto track again. That's certainly our hope. On access, access takes various forms. Certainly on Welsh Shilluk is a particular example, but it's only one example of many where we've been asked to go to a particular areas. We wanted to go to Kajikaji the other day, and we had to wait 4 days before we were able to get clearance to go. In the end, I asked our forces, the Nepalese group that was going down the road there, who had been turned back, I think 3 days in a row. They slept at the checkpoint and finally were able to overnight, and finally able to go down there the following morning. We will continue to be robust about wanting to go to particular places, and we will make that clear to the government. But let me give you another example of a lack of access. We have well over 100 military personnel who are joining various our peacekeeping groups across the country who are waiting outside the country for visas at the moment, and there's some problem within the bureaucracy of the government, which is not allowing them to be able to get into the country. This is a real problem, and it interferes with our effective operations of our forces. As I said to the government, we as the UN are required by the Security Council to record areas where there have been access problems or where we have a violation of a state of forces agreement that has been signed between the UN and the government of South Sudan. And we record those and we send those through the Security Council. I would be delighted if we were able to see a reduction in the number of those violations. And so we were able to say to the Security Council, the situation is getting better. I think that would be positive on all sides, both on the government side and on for the UN as well. So I would like to see a greater degree of compliance with agreements that have already been signed some time ago.
I'm David Lemuria for Channel News Asia. Yesterday the President urged people living in the protection of civilian sites to move back to their homes. Is this something the mission is advocating for or supports that? And if that's true, how is the mission, how will it support the transition between leaving the camps and going back and settling back in their homes?
This is a very good question, thank you. Yes, we do support people moving out of the protection of civilian camps, but that has to happen voluntarily from the people who leave. We're not pushing them out. But what we need to be able to do is to establish the conditions which would encourage them to go back. And there are two major conditions. One is that they feel secure physically from a security point of view, that when they are going back, they are going back to their homes and are not going to be in threat of their or risk of their lives. And I have asked our peacekeeping forces, wherever possible, to be able to push out of the camps and start doing patrols in conjunction with the governor of the particular area, so that these people can have a greater sense of confidence about being able to move back. The second part of that confidence is making sure that they have the ability to, particularly when they move back where their livelihoods have been destroyed, where they don't have necessarily anything to fall back on, is to make sure that food distributions, for example, are able to happen in the place of their residence. And we are looking at that with humanitarian organisations to try and coordinate that so that is able to happen. And we've done that. For example, I'll give you one small example in Leah, where we do food distributions in the town of Leah. And if anybody from the protection of civilians site, which is about 16 or 1700 people near our the camp we have them, the peacekeeping camp, they have to go into town to pick it up, and so more people are slowly starting to drift back to their homes. So it's a voluntary thing, but we can try and put the conditions in place for people to move back. It's incredibly important over the next couple of months, because, as you know, the rainy season will be here and people will need to start planting. And if they miss this planting season, then we are condemned to having another cycle of a year for people to be in camps because they can't go back to their homes. So we're anxious that we're able to move people along as much as possible.
It's Nelson from Radio Mirai again. Would you tell us more about the humanitarian response plan that was actually announced yesterday?
Without wanting to go right through the whole thing, because I think it might be available online, I think what the price tag on is at about $1.6 billion. There's an increase in the number of people that we're trying to reach with, particularly with food aid. That's the critical issue, and that's getting more than 5.5 million people will be in food deficit this year. So that is an increase from last year of about 500,000 people. But in addition to that, obviously there's an array of health requirements that is needed in addition to food. Although food takes up about $1 billion of that $1.5 billion, or a bit slightly more than $1.5 billion. In addition to that, what we are trying to do is to look at not just at simple kind of basic food supply, but also some of the seeds, tools, fishing equipment, etc., which will enable people to be more self-sufficient on top of that as well. And that's part of the array of support, as well as to education and, as I said, to health services. So it's a very big package. The critical issue will be whether the donors will be able to support it. I hope they do, because clearly people are in desperate need. And you know what we would like, obviously, is the government has said that it would provide, I think, 1% of the total as well from its budget, and we would certainly welcome the government's contribution as they committed to when it was launched earlier this week.
Mr. David, you said that you're hoping that the peace process gets back on track. Obviously, that's very challenging with so many fragmented armed groups, not just between the opposition, that is the IO, and the government, but there are so many armed groups in the Equatorias and parts of the Greater Upper Nile and Greater Unity State. My question is, how long do you think South Sudanese can take before the UN or the international community actually decides to take a stronger step to try to make sure that South Sudan survives?
Well, I think the international community and the UN have been taking some pretty strong steps. If you read the, for example, the response from the Security Council, I can't think of a place where it was any stronger than the statements that have come out of the Security Council. But it depends on what you're anticipating. In a sense, the UN's able to do. We have 12,000 troops on here trying to keep the peace, but there is basically, as you say, there has been some fragmentation, and there's not a lot of peace to be kept at the moment. But ultimately, it's only through a negotiated process, which is in track certainly from the regional countries supporting the promotion of a peace agreement, that's definitely there, and it's been there's been a recommitment of that over the last two or three weeks. So we're hopeful that commitment will provide the spark to get the peace process back on track again.
Great. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming, and we hope to see you again soon.